I think when we talk about manned space flight, the first attempt in this direction, the first serious attempt, will be the so-called Project Mercury, which is a program supported and financed and sponsored by the National Space Administration. On that program Mercury, it is planned to fire a manned capsule with an Atlas vehicle into a low orbit and let the capsule pilot go around the Earth several times, and then with the help of a retardation maneuver, this nose cone will slip back into the atmosphere, will be retarded by aerodynamic drag, and finally land in the water where it will be shipped in the, where it will be fished out of the water like our Jupiter nose cones with the monkeys aboard.
Yes.
This will definitely be man's first step into an orbit, and from there on, it doesn't take much imagination to see that with a big booster like the Saturn at the bottom of such a vehicle, you need not limit this to one man, but you can send a whole busload of people up into an orbit.
Yes, and what I mainly meant to point out was this, that the space station, as it has been discussed before, which has as its main job the observation of the Earth, will be in a rather low orbit, while the communication satellites, the telephone satellites, let's call them, have to be some 22,000 miles away.
Yes, actually, there is a question of whether it is realistic to talk about just one space station. It depends very much on what the purpose of such a station is. Shall we say, the choice of the orbit of a space station depends very much on its purpose.
Yes.
For example, if you want to use a space station to maintain a continuous surveillance of the weather development on Earth, then it is very important to put these such a satellite, such a space station, into a very into a near polar orbit, so that you can see the weather developments over the polar areas also.
Yeah. Yes, it would also have an orbit differently located, so to speak, with respect to the Earth. The telephone satellites would be over the equator.
That is right.
While this one should go over the poles or very near the poles.
Yes.
But what I've said first is that it also would be much nearer to the ground.
Yes, I think both is correct. My point is I think there may be several satellites for several applications. There may be manned space stations for in connection with the communication satellite project in the future, and there may be lower space stations going over polar orbits for weather observation,
yeah,
and there may be others in between.
Earth Watch, you know, polar orbit replaced the iceberg patrol at the same time.
Yes.
Weather reporting, even, what might
or
be...
For military observational purposes, you want to have highly inclined orbits,
yes,
too, so you
yes
can cover the northern and the southern hemispheres.
And they could take in what might be called accident reporting. That's,
yes,
for example, a wrecked ship or things,
yes,
like this.
Yes.
They could report,
yes,
on that. Now, these would go very nearly over the poles, if not over the poles, and would be quite close. Then, is there any reason for having something at an intermediate distance? Let's say if this Earth Watch satellite, as I like to call it, is in a 400-mile orbit.
Well, I think we have to watch the Van Allen belt.
Yes, we sure do.
The Van Allen belt begins at an altitude of approximately 700 miles and stretches out to altitudes very close to those envisioned for the communication satellite.
Yes.
Whereas it doesn't seem to be too difficult to penetrate the Van Allen belt in a fast departure, say, to the moon or the planets, where your stay time in the Van Allen belt would be quite limited. There seems to be a major problem of leaving a permanent manned space station right in the Van Allen belt. It would,
yes,
have to provide so much shielding that the weight penalty is,
yes,
too high.
At the moment, it does not look impossible, but it certainly looks impracticable.
Yes, in other words, the way it looks today is you stay below it, which means below 700 miles approximately, or you just go much further
beyond
out.
Beyond 20,000.
Unless you have very good reasons,
yeah,
to build a well-shielded,
yeah,
space station right within the Van Allen belt, it is just not too attractive.
No, it's a little bit like the speed of sound. At 0.8 of the speed of sound, everything is fine. At 1.2, everything is fine again, but not in between.
Only this belt is a lot wider.
It's a lot wider. Well, the only reason I could see for a heavily shielded station in the belt would be one designed to observe the belt itself. And I think that could be done without a manned station.
Yes, actually, the human body has no sensors to give you any of the information you want. What we would like to find out right now, for example, is what is the percentage of protons and electrons in this belt? What is their energy spectrum and so forth? Now, the human body has no...
Which the human observer couldn't do anyway.
Organs. You may be able to kill a man in that belt, but you still he still wouldn't know what exactly killed him. So you need instrumentation to give you this kind of information, and there's no reason why this cannot be radioed down to the ground from an unmanned satellite.
With reference to the first man in orbit, the flight of the astronaut, will he be carried into orbit by an Atlas missile, so to speak, cold, or will he have previous experience on a smaller scale?
That's a good question. The National Space Administration has actually called us here at Huntsville in to provide some hardware for the initial training flights of these astronauts. The plan is to put the man right from the beginning into the ultimate capsule, which will later on be used for the orbital flights with Atlases. But his first flights will be conducted from the nose of a Redstone vehicle only over a range of approximately 150 to 200 miles. In this fashion, we will give him a six-minute ride through the zero-gravity condition and a typical re-entry with ensuing parachute landing and being fished out of the water.
In short, the nose cone ride in a Redstone will provide him more or less with the experience, except that the zero-G period, which he would spend in orbit, has been trimmed from...
Pretty good feeling of what he will be up against when he finally boards that Atlas.
Will they all get the... Since it is not certain, and I understand it will not be certain until fairly much the last moment which one actually goes into orbit, will they all get such a nose cone ride?
I think this is to be expected, yes. We are furnishing several Redstone vehicles, and it's, of course, entirely up to the NASA, to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, to decide who will take the first ride.
Yes, but I mean they will have had several people who had the nose cone ride in preparation for the orbital flight.
Yes, you see, this is necessary to have several test pilots standing by because you have to be in perfect physical conditions for these early tests, and it can always be that a man catches a cold and everything else has been prepared, the ships are in position, and the man wakes up with a head cold and doesn't qualify that day. In this case, the number two man will be slipped in.
Now, in talking about the investigation of the Van Allen layer, which is a most interesting, if unexpected, item that we didn't know about a few years ago, you said that for this particular observation, instruments are far superior to men because men happens to lack the organ which could make the determination, which could make the discoveries, if you want, that the instruments can. This, of course, brings up the general question of when is man needed in space? Where does he have to step in because his instruments now don't do the job anymore?
Well, I think very fundamentally, the instrumentation has its limits. You can design instrumentation for a known objective. You have to specify in advance what information you seek, and then build your instrumentation accordingly so that it furnishes you with the answers.
So you have to know what to look for in order to ask intelligent questions via the instrument.
Precisely.
Design.
And so, as I see it, man is necessary wherever you are confronted with a great unknown, where you just don't know what to look for and where you expect the unexpected, against which you cannot design any machinery. Just to illustrate my point... Suppose we were living on another star and wanted to find out what kind of life exists in the Brazilian jungles. and you would have to build a telemeter package to furnish you all the answers about snakes and birds and crocodiles, but also bacteria
and insects, do these insects
and everything.
Eat other insects or plants?
And a question of contagious diseases and what have you in the Brazilian jungles. You'd be confronted with a rather formidable problem, because not knowing what to expect, you couldn't design this machinery to meet all your objectives, and as a result, the old-fashioned method of the Spanish explorers, but just sending a man there for a look-see, is still the most effective.
Yes, and of course now we would see to it that this man is well-protected, or as well-protected as we can make it, but it is then inherently the higher versatility of the brain over the instrument which counts.
Wherever you need judgment, wherever you need coordination of several apparently irrelevant and disconnected pieces of information and put a story together out of a number of apparently independent inputs, the human brain still cannot be beat.
Cannot be beat, and won't be for a long time.
No, I think never will.
Now, this gets us to the next topic. We can penetrate the Van Allen there. We can go out farther into space. Where will we go first?
Well, I think in the area of deep space penetration, the most logical step after manned orbital flight and safe return from orbital flight has been obtained and demonstrated, we will probably expect to send a few men around the moon on a long-stretched flight path behind the unknown far side of the moon, and return them back into the Earth atmosphere with an ensuing aerodynamic deceleration and landing. Now, such a flight would not include a landing on the surface of the moon.
No.
It would be essentially a high-speed power maneuver on the outbound leg to get us that far out, and then as the rocket comes almost to a standstill behind the moon would sweep through between rocket and Earth, and then it would fall back towards the Earth under the gravitational pull of the Earth and would tangentially sweep into the Earth's atmosphere and land.
Yes, so the first deep space trip for people is still, as we said many years ago, the
trip
flight
around
the moon without landing.
Yes.
Then, of course, when it comes to the neighboring planets, we have this nice toss-up that we know nothing about Venus at the moment, so this makes it more interesting, but we don't know what to protect against. While Mars doesn't look very hospitable, but at least we know a lot about it.
Yes. Well, as far as flights to Venus and Mars is concerned, the difficulties are about equal. It is a little closer to Venus to get there than to Mars, but Venus has a stronger gravitational field of her own, so it takes a little more velocity to put a rocket, say, into orbit around Venus than it would cost to put it in orbit around Mars.
Yes.
So it's about equal.
Yes, in spite of the somewhat greater distance to Mars, the engineering problem is very much the same, and the fuel problem is likely to be very much the same.
And as you just said, in the case of Mars, due to the fact that the atmosphere is transparent, we know a little better how to equip our machinery, how to build our automatic instrumentation to give us more information on Mars.
Yes, we know what questions to ask.
For example, photographing Mars' surface from an orbit around Mars would be a very interesting thing, and we would know right now how to design such equipment. We could entirely envision televising such pictures back to the Earth and give us some answers to such riddles as, do the Martian canals really exist?
Are they canals?
Are they canals?
Are they?
Or what are they? Whereas in the case of Venus, it would probably be necessary to send a kind of a glide bomb into the Venus atmosphere with television equipment and see whether that thing ever comes out of the Venus atmosphere and take some pictures on what's underneath, or whether it'll crash in the ground without telling us anything, thus indicating that the clouds go all the way down to the ground.
Yes, in other words, we do know enough about Mars to design equipment. In the case of Venus, we first would have to gather experience.
Yes.
We would have to almost engineer a number of failures in order to know how to avoid them.
Yes, yes.
And then, of course, men fled to these neighboring planets would follow these unmanned probes, which have given the final information.
Yes, I think to the planets we should expect unmanned probes first, maybe even one-way probes that just go out to the planet, either pass those planets in a close pass or go in orbit around these planets and televise their information and telemeter their information back to the Earth.
Yes. And man, of course, will follow, as man always has.
Yes.
And now we come to a semi-philosophical question. What right does man have in space?
Well, it has been stated that we don't belong there because outer space is a realm of God and we better stay on this Earth. I don't like the implication of these statements because it could be construed as to mean that the Earth itself does not belong to the realm of God.
If you permit me to interrupt you, this is precisely the answer I gave once at a meeting where somebody came up with this question. I said, and now, in other words, the Lord is not present here.
Well, this is the way I feel about it.
A very red face and a silent withdrawal. Mm-hmm. So this reasoning, of course, is primitive and nonsense.
Yes. I think if the Lord didn't want us to go into outer space, he would simply deny us the means of doing it. And the fact that he seems to support our projects and allows us to demonstrate that
we do have the brains. Our bodies are built better for high accelerations than the bodies of any other animals except our relatives, the primates. So it looks very much, if the term can be used here in this connection, like something preordained.
Precisely.
But I wanted to bring this up because that question does come up every once in a while, mostly from laymen, I mean now in the theological sense, because the theologians who have been thinking about this problem for about as long as we have been talking about the engineering problems are, of course, convinced that there is no obstacle from where they sit.
Well, the Pope himself has blessed the idea of flight into outer space during the meeting of the International Astronautical Federation in Rome in 1957, I believe, or was it 56?
No, 57.
57, and he stated very plainly that God has in no way limited man to this planet, and that the Catholic Church saw no objections whatsoever to this endeavor of exploring other worlds.
I read his statement both in the original French and the English translation. That's why I said the theologians, of course, who have been thinking about this, will not voice this objection. It comes only from circles of laymen.
I think it is a great tragedy that so many people still believe that religion and science are not compatible, and it's a fundamental struggle on between what you might call search for faith and search for truth. I think with every new mystery that science has solved, it has also discovered at least three new questions which science hasn't solved yet.
Yes.
And I think the closer we get to the facts, and the more we learn about the mysteries of nature, the more we learn to adore and to just become more humble in our outlook.
Yes, and this is bound to happen. I have a quotation there from the French philosopher Pascal, which I love and which I have used before on occasion. Where Pascal said that knowledge can be compared to an expanding sphere. The larger it grows, the more points of it will touch the unknown.
Yes.
That is precisely the same you just said before.
Yes.
As our knowledge expands, and this time the word is to be taken literally, one day we will run into other life forms. And this, of course, is the second most favorite question that always comes up after every lecture about other life elsewhere.
Well, I think there's enough evidence today that at least some low forms of life exist on Mars.
Yes, that can be accepted as
we know
established.
That whenever the snow melts on the northern or the southern polar cap of Mars and humidity reaches the moderate latitudes, that vegetation seems to spring into life, and large areas of Mars are covered by a bluish and greenish hue. In fall, on that particular hemisphere of Mars, this vegetation seems to wither, and these seasonal effects appear during every Martian year.
They come up every year, and there is one other little item which is very interesting. You said that the vegetation is bluish green or greenish blue. Well, a Russian astronomer by the name of Tikhov has been looking around on Earth for equivalent color values in vegetation, and he found them strangely enough in the North Siberian forests. And then he made additional measurements which gave the result that a forest in the temperate zone will radiate or reflect about 25% of the infrared of the heat rays that hit the leaves. The North Siberian forest cannot afford this. It does not reflect more than about 2% of the infrared rays. And the Martian plants have the same color value. They, of course, since Mars is farther from the sun, also cannot afford to waste any infrared that may strike them. So we are pretty certain about life on Mars, at least vegetation. But when the public asks this question, they always have something more than plant life in mind. They are not even interested just in the neighboring planets. They mean, well, they say the universe, they mean the galaxy as a whole.
Well, I have no doubt whatsoever that in the vast depths of the universe, there will not be just a few hundred, but probably millions of planets capable of supporting even higher forms of life. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if there are some planets among them that are capable of supporting even a much higher form of life than this Earth. In other words, that there are intelligent beings around somewhere who, for whom we with all our intelligence would be no match.
Well, of course, this is the same way I feel about it. And I think the most interesting moment in history that could happen is if two such cultures meet.
Yes, it certainly would. Whether we'll ever be able to visit such a planet remains to be seen, but in 25 years of work in the missile and space field, I've always found out that whenever I use the word impossible, I ultimately wind up at the losing end.
You ultimately wind up building it.
Yes, I'm building it.